Welcome. I'm Richard James from the Centre for the Study of Higher Education. I just want to begin with some statistics. Lynn Meek and I just calculated that 57% of the registrants for this evening's seminar have attended, which means that 43% of the higher education policy community realises that there's much better things you can do on a spring evening than be discussing higher education policy. Previously, we thought that running the series in winter was a problem because the wet, cold winter evenings might keep people away. I think it might be, in fact, the very balmy spring evenings that keep people away. Nonetheless, it's good to see you all here. And Lynn Meek, who's the director of the L.H. Martin Institute, of course, and myself are very happy with the policy seminars that we've run this year. We took the experiment of running one in Brisbane and one in Perth. Probably the numbers in Brisbane weren't as good as we'd hoped, but the numbers in Perth were very good. So we're pleased with that, and we might continue with that model into the future. It's impeccable timing on our part because today has been quite a significant day in terms of higher education being in the news. And if you were able to get to your computer at all today, you will have seen the very significant report from Universities of Australia that has been released, looking at the contribution of higher education and our universities to national productivity and trying to make some quantitative estimate of that contribution. And I would commend that that report to you. And at the same time, we've seen the release of the rather bizarre QS rankings, if I can say that, which have 8 of our universities in the top 100, the group of 8, as it turns out, and 23, I believe, of our universities in the top 500, which is about 60% of our universities overall. The QS rankings, I have to say, might flatter us. I don't think we ought to take them too seriously. And if I put this up just to tease you with one point. You see, the QS rankings lack credibility at the point between our number 8 ranked university and our number 9 ranked in terms of the global ranking. That says something about the QS methodology, which heavily emphasises reputation over more substantial things. Nonetheless, another interesting outcome today and one worth having a closer look at. We're very pleased to have Glyn Davis and Jane Den Hollander as our speakers this evening. We've given them quite a tough task, and that is to look at whether or not and in what way we might have a more integrated, coherent and sustainable policy architecture for tertiary education in Australia. Excuse me, I don't know what I did then. I think Glyn's going to start, is that correct?
Certainly.
And you are suffering loss of voice? Glyn Davis is the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Melbourne and he's presently the Chair of the Board of Universities Australia. Jane Den Hollander is the Vice-Chancellor of Deakin University and she's also a board member of Universities Australia. Jane started her vice-chancellorship in July, coming to Deakin from Curtin, where she was a deputy vice-chancellor, and we're very pleased that you've joined us in Victoria, Jane, and we're very pleased that you've joined us in presenting this evening. The format is, as always, 15 or 20 minutes each from our speakers and then an open discussion. Glyn, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the invitation to speak tonight. I'm going to be brief for three reasons. The first is I don't claim expertise about what an integrated system should look like. The second is there's so much knowledge in the room, it would be pointless to talk at you. And the third is clearly I'm losing my voice. And I suspect before my 15 minutes are out, I'll be completely without voice. A vice chancellor without voice is an interesting concept and much to be welcomed, I fear. So I'm going to work from the presumption that there are powerful reasons to want an integrated system, and I'm going to try and say why I think it's important and then what I think the ingredients might look at. The reason I think it's important is the single one. It's hard to see how there's any prospect of the government's participation targets being met without a more integrated system. And participation comes in two forms, the 40% of students under people under 35 with a degree, I think we will meet relatively easily, notwithstanding some scepticism from others. But I can't see any way of meeting a 20% participation from low SES without much better pathways. I can't see how, other than an integrated system. And I think that absolutely laudable goal is a reason itself to go for an integrated system. I don't think you need a further explanation, though I'm sure there are many others that we could imagine. And now is the right time to have this conversation. We are in the middle of changes to higher education, as we all know, because we live them, that are as profound as anything that we went through in the 80s and the early 90s. An uncapped demand-driven system to start next January, but in practice already here, is revolutionary. We've never experienced that, and almost nobody else has either. New Zealand, I think, being the only brief example of such a system. And truth is, none of us know what it's going to mean. But we can say it's going to change the game quite profoundly. And that's happening alongside really important changes in the VET system and the experimentation in a number of places with what is effectively a voucher system in VET and the reorganisation of VET systems at state level. These two things are not coordinated, but they're happening at the same time, and they have the potential to each be very important. So I'm going to suggest that this is the right moment to have a discussion about an integrated national system, and I want to suggest three dimensions before my voice gives up. And they are common standards, policy stability, and provider specialisation. And those are the things I'm going to talk about. So I'm going to start with common standards. Markets work best when the rules are clear, when the products on offer are based on a shared understanding about their quality and price. And in most industries, and here's food as an example, we do this in pretty standard ways. We have rules about labelling, we have rules about minimum quality standards, we require transparent information about content, and there are sanctions against those who engage in deceptive or misleading practice. This is our standard model of industry regulation when it's a genuine market. We've said that our objective is to have a market, because otherwise why have a demand-driven system? So the same rules should apply. And experience in other sectors show that it can work. These are not barriers to entry. They're not ways to stifle competition. And I've got food up, but you could think about exactly the same for the regulatory, for the financial industry. This is how we regulate the financial industry. And although food may seem a strange analogy, it just underlines and reflect the fact that I was writing this at lunchtime, it underlines a simple point that we take food regulation for granted because it works quietly but effectively, it protects us from misleading products, and it still allows a large and diverse industry. And that's what common standards do. They just provide a basis on which a market can be efficient because it can be transparent and fast. It seems to me that the work we've seen on TEXA and the discussions about a national VET regulator follow pretty much the same logic. They're not seeking to constrain competition, they are seeking to impose minimum standards for those who seek to join the market. And labelling legislation is necessarily part of that. It's perfectly reasonable to say a university has these characteristics, a higher education provider has these characteristics, and that's what you're supporting and that's what you're testing against. It seems to me tough-minded, clear and enforced standards are the basis for an effective operating market for us in higher education, as they are in the rest of our economy. We just don't like talking about it like that because it feels wrong. But in fact, we are talking about how we run a system rather than about what it is we do inside each institution. The second thing that I think is really important is policy stability. Now, this can seem a bit counterintuitive, given we're in the middle of a period of great change, and we all yearn for policy stability unless we're unhappy with the policy, in which case we agitate as fast as possible to get it changed. And we've not really gone in for policy stability. If you think back over the Australian landscape, over, say, the last half century, you get the Murray Commission report in 1958, and it sets up a Commonwealth framework. It prevails through roughly to 1973, when the Whitlam government changes the rules quite profoundly with moving to free education. It, in turn, lasts less than 20 years before we get to the Dawkins period and its changes. and clearly it's around 20 years between Dawkins and the move to a demand-driven system. So a stable framework is 20 years, it isn't a lifetime. But contrast that, as many, many people have done, with the experience of the United States, and in particular the Californian system, which is extremely well known. The Californian Master Plan of 1960 allocated responsibility, and people forget that it wasn't just to the higher end universities, it was across the board, community colleges leading to state universities, leading to the UC system, and each with an express role and clearly regulated and designed to work together as a system. And that policy stability has endured since 1960 and continues in California. Not for a minute do I think we're about to adopt the Californian system, although I think there'll be lots of merit in thinking about it, but it does seem to me we are going to have to move pretty carefully once we've established a market with common rules to some period of policy stability, or the truth is no one will ever have the time or opportunity to work out what are the strategic possibilities inside this new system we've created. The risk is if it changes so quickly. Given we have a minority government and we're at best 2 years from a federal election, how long this system will endure in its present form is very hard to see. But it's difficult to see how institutions are going to make choices without some sense of, in particular those who wish to grow, that the demand-driven system is going to continue. Because it could be quite a catastrophic view if you load up additional students and then discover that you've got no further scope for expansion. So that's important. It's also important, I think, to get some policy clarity around the future role of TAFE. As TAFEs are now beginning to award bachelor's degrees, and in some cases master's degrees, as there are now private education institutions offering PhDs, we clearly have potential for a fair bit of confusion and uncertainty. And again, common rules and national regulation is a way of being clear. Now, that's not an argument to say that some people shouldn't be allowed to do some things. It is an argument to say there should be some clarity about who does what, why, and what it takes before, for example, you can offer a PhD program. And that's as much an issue inside the university sector as it is more broadly. And the third of these policy design principles I think we should consider is about how we achieve system stability. And here I just want to reflect for a minute on one of the great experiences I've had over the last few years, which is being a member of the Hong Kong Grants Committee in Hong Kong, well, obviously in Hong Kong, but covering all of the Hong Kong institutions, public and private. This is an extreme model of what separation from government can be. This committee, which has a membership of 25, five of whom are heads of non-Hong Kong-based institutions, including the just retired Vice-Chancellor of Oxford and Stanford. Now it's a pretty interesting group. It actually distributes all the budget in Hong Kong for higher education. And they have rules that say the government can't give money to an individual institution for a favoured project. It has to go through the committee, which forces transparency all the time on the system and means universities can't lobby government. There's no point lobbying government because if you succeed, you're then in a competition where you've got no particular sort of guarantee that you're going to get anything out of it. Now, we once had this system, which people have forgotten, but this was the Murray system, introduced in 1958 by not only by Prime Minister Robert Menzies, but memorably chaired by L.H. Martin, whose name we reflect on tonight. And this system actually oversaw what was then the most significant period of rapid expansion of the system we had ever undertaken. As it happens, the last 3 years have outshone that, but until then. And it was done through a commission, it had some distance from government, it made allocation decisions, and it ensured that, in a sense, the university system kept its distance from government because there was no great advantage in lobbying government directly. It is interesting to speculate whether TEXA and the National Vet Regulator might in time take on this character. And it's not implausible to think about an evolution toward a system that has a single set of rules, that has a common framework for what we're trying to do, that has policy stability, and that is overseen by a national body of this character that's pretty much based on those we've already begun to set up. This, I think, is a plausible way forward, and people are beginning in curious and interesting ways to think about this again. There are a whole set of other parts of the system that would have to come under discussion to make this happen, including the funding model, because one of the things that we all aspire to, which is more system diversity, will not happen while we have the current funding model in which the income to institutions bears no relationship to the cost of providing particular courses. There's a good reason why no one specialises in engineering in this country, and that's because you'd go broke if you did it, because you'd never cover the costs. It's why every university has a very large business school, whether or not it fits their mission, because that's an important part of paying their way. But if you thought about a system coming out of the base funding review that actually aligned costs and income, so that you weren't penalised if you're in some fields and advantaged in others, but roughly you're in equilibrium whichever fields you're in, then suddenly you've got the other missing piece that would make it possible to have a system where you could specialise with confidence, secure in the knowledge that the system was stable and that your strategy would be allowed to play out over the long term, and with the prospect that you would then have all the advantages of being able to specialise and focus. And that would be particularly the case for metro institutions, but it's interesting to think about how some of our regional institutions will respond, and I'm looking forward to hearing Jane on this question, who's covering both region and urban. But it means, for example, that the trend toward dual sectors, which we've long seen in Victoria and in the Northern Territory, but is now on the agenda in other places, including the ACT, to see whether that might emerge as the standard model, for example, where you've got large TAFEs operating near large universities, particularly outside metro areas. I don't know whether that's the future, but it's another part of a more diverse picture, and it would allow a system to evolve in which TAFE and higher ed, TAFE and university are yoked together in a very formal way. We talk about it as an integrated system. Well, if many of these are part of the same institutions, that would be particularly the case. I note a speech that Bruce McKenzie, the chief executive at Holmes Glen, gave recently, in which he talked about how well TAFE does in terms of bringing in low SES students, and he compared them in very pointed ways with the higher education system. TAFE institutions, he noted, are outperforming universities across almost every characteristic of disadvantage and underrepresentation. In proportional terms, TAFE reached twice as many students from low SES backgrounds and more than twice as many students from rural areas and four times as many Indigenous students, he said, arguing that, as I guess the starting point, that if we are going to make a difference to participation in this country, we aren't going to make it just from one part of the system. We aren't going to make it just from universities, however crucial and important universities are as part of their picture. So, to close, while I still have a voice, an integrated tertiary system, I think, is an important goal. It's important for participation. It needs to be underpinned by common rules. It would benefit from a stable policy architecture, including funding models, and hopefully it would allow providers to specialise in areas of strength if that's what they chose to do. It doesn't force them to do it. And much of the architecture necessary to do that is either already in place or close at hand. This isn't thinking about a system that's impossible to achieve. This is actually thinking about a system that we could take much of the existing framework, put it together and make this possible. And I think it's a challenge worth serious consideration and a conversation, a national conversation, we should have. Thank you.
And Jane, over to you.
Okay. Well, it's very nice to be here. I'm a little daunting to follow the chair of the Universities Australia board. I'm going to talk from the perspective of a reasonably new Vice-Chancellor. I still remember the coal face reasonably well of what it was like down there to do some of the things that one had to do in universities. And I notice there's many of you in the room who are at the coal face. I'll probably end up agreeing furiously with Glyn, but I'm going to take a proposition before then that might be slightly different. So the words and the language used in this proposal are quite strong and are deliberately provocative, and in my view may understate the current state of play. I speak as a Vice-Chancellor of a non-aligned university, and non-aligned after having been within the cosy bosom of the ATN and before that the very cosy bosom of the G8 is quite an interesting and quite cool and lonely place of an average day. But firstly, friends, it's just too easy, I think, to write off. Particularly the Rudd-Gillard Education revolution as often more spin than substance. And I think history informs our future, and so I want to sidetrack to something that has informed my view and my approach, and which for me provides a context of where we are now. And of course, this is from my perspective, my history and my experience, and I need to use that in the university I'm in. So I immigrated to Australia 16, 17 years ago. I recall getting a job at UWA. Alan Robson was the DVC. Faye Gale was running the show, and they were focused on the policy of the day. And I was given an original copy of A Fair Chance for All and was asked to do something with it. Just to recap for the newbies in the room, A Fair Chance for All was the Australian government's view of the day of what we needed to do to improve access and participation, and for the first time it named the targeted equity groups that we now use quite routinely. This was the mid-90s. I'd come from the UK, where policy around access was not on the agenda. Margaret Thatcher, first as Thatcher the Milk Snatcher, Minister for Education, and then as Prime Minister, to be superseded by John Major had lain waste to quite a few things, most particularly in the sector we come from. A Fair Chance for All remains, I think, profoundly a brave statement about what was needed to be done. And I've used it because deregulation and access and participation are such an issue today. UWA at the time was seen as the most exclusive university in the country, taking students from pretty much 14 schools, a handful of schools, and asserting that they could never, and there's a famous memo, which was to me, about the vortex of mediocrity and dropping standards. Opposition to Fair Chance for All was deep and wide. But good policy, that has at least a kernel of truth does have impact, even if it does not survive a political cycle. Today, UWA has a great approach to access and participation that could probably teach quite a few places on this side of the Nullarbor a thing or two. Today, a policy derided at the time is seen in the foundations of that university, in WA, my university in Victoria, and is by most of the universities represented in this room. We should hold on to that thought for a minute. So I don't think we can easily dismiss as spin some significant developments in recent times as the Bradley Review and the federal government's response through the very specific attainment and access that's been agreed. The setting up of TEXA, the establishment of HEP, the Higher Education Participation Partnership, and achievement within HEP of standards being linked to funding. We may not like any of this, but it is a consistent evolution in my view from what began in the late 80s, 90s under Hawke Keating and has been given shape by Rudd Gillard in their response to Bradley. The difference now is teeth, and increasingly sharp they appear to be, and of course the competitive environment we find ourselves in. So that's my preamble and my context, and I thought I'd go a bit specific on some of the things. I didn't predict that Glyn would take a wider view, but I thought he might, and so I thought I'd take a personal view of what it feels like at the coalface. The participation attainment access targets are designed to achieve productivity growth in Australia and to, quote, a highly educated workforce with the skills and capacity to advance the growth of a dynamic knowledge economy. We've heard it so many times we can all memorise it. Well, that may sound like spin to us, but most voters agree that increasing the number of people attaining a bachelor-level qualification is a fine thing. I'm increasingly surprised at how many people know about this thing. So, what do we do about it? I agree and find it quite limiting that between A Fair Chance for All and transforming Australia's higher education system, two policy statements which I think have caught the attention of the nation, there's been lots of terrible things have happened. There's been a lot of noise and nonsense, and we've endured all sorts of things. And I wrote down all the acronyms I could remember. I'm not going to tell you, speak them all. CHESNs, HEAMS, SLEs, HUAs, LTPF, my university, to name but a few of the really expensive and time-consuming activities enshrined in policy that have brought us to the level of regulation we now found ourselves enmeshed in. And now we wish to fully integrate the tertiary education system. Aren't we already integrated, I think? We must be very careful, I think, what we wish for. What precisely do we mean by full integration? Do we have a shared view on that with the vet sector? Do we have a shared view on that with state governments and with Commonwealth governments? We need to be careful what we wish for. How will a fully integrated system improve regional planning in a university such as mine? How will it help cross-sectoral mobility, combined qualifications, funding? Also, why is it that universities must be seen and managed through the same lens as vet providers and the private providers? Just how integrated do we need to be to achieve the things mentioned in the preamble that you've all read today? The key questions for me must be, as a new Vice-Chancellor, will students be better educated in an integrated system? Will productivity improve? We saw the paper today. Will people want to work in universities? I get that we must reassure the international community that Australia is a preferred place of study, and I get that Australia is globally competitive and must be in the tertiary education market. I'm sure none of us would deny it's been important to develop a regulatory framework to ease out the non-performers and, I quote, the shonky misbehaviours. We have all taken a deep breath with the TEXO legislation. We might have to wait a year or two to exhale, but it's looking quite hopeful. But what are the examples of integration in our current system? And so I had a quick look. The Australian Qualifications Framework comes to mind. The objects of the AQF contain all the hallmarks of what we expect a truly integrated system to look like. A contemporary and flexible framework that accommodates the diversity of purposes of Australian education. They actually say the diversity of purposes. Contributes to national economic performance. Assists people to move easily and readily between different education and training sectors. Supports and enhances the national and international mobility. None of us would deny these AQF objectives. In fact, the AQF, it appears to me, is the single most comprehensive national qualifications framework in the world. Probably you can't get more integrated than that. And that we know that when the current iteration of the AQF was proposed, many parts of the sector objected. Claims that the reforms proposed limited flexibility, would reduce choice and pathways available to students. It was linear and sequential when that's not how students behave, would reduce innovation in our sector and impose a regulation rather than a qualitative descriptive approach. It's got better, I think, as a consequence of all of our feedback, but to what extent do you think that it now limits our creativity and our entrepreneurship in our sector? We must therefore be careful what we wish for. And I've decided to be deliberately provocative on this basis and to take it down to the level of where it impacts in the kind of people who work day to day in a classroom. A truly integrated approach must have benefits for those who use it. The alleged lack of integration between vet and universities may be true to some degree, but very large numbers of students, and I won't give you the numbers, seem to successfully navigate the sector each year and move backwards and forwards between TAFE institutes and universities along their chosen pathways with no harm or concerns. Maybe I've simplified it. What benefits, though, are we striving for? And do we need a sledgehammer to fix it? I always go back something my old supervisor told me. Always make sure, Jane, that you do no harm. I don't think we worry about that enough as we propose some of the frameworks that we dream up that aspire to solve everything. They generally don't, and they are generally expensive in the making and in the breaking. Take HEAMS and the CHESN as a lesson. Vet and universities have different purposes, in my view, and different approaches. I think they are doing extraordinarily well in some of the things that they do. What is wrong with our separate purposes? And will a single regulated system improve productivity and family aspirations? I think we need to think about that quite carefully. So let's look at what may assist the country, our students. Is our policy cycle too short? I wrote that and then realised I actually meant, is our political cycle too short? And of course it is. Why is it that the population as a whole don't see us as vote worthy? My new neighbours in Geelong were absolutely astonished when I raised this just recently as a consequence of this. They believe that Deakin has saved Geelong. They believe that absolutely firmly. But they were shocked that I wanted it to be an electoral issue, that universities get attention. And what would I do with all those mad politicians running all over the place? Point taken. The status and position of our elected leaders is as much an issue as our funding and policy dilemmas. I didn't pursue it that much further. So the question I have is how to achieve consistent good policy. And I agree absolutely with Glenn. How do we get to consistent policy that can be implemented, can be evaluated, and then moderately tweaked to do the things that we do? Why do we have to chop and change with the incredible speed that we do across the political divide and across the philosophical divide that we have? So I looked then at the latest example I have, which was IELTS. And I was in China last week, and I met a fully trained nurse who did her study in Australia, just graduated. She has an IELTS overall score of 7.5. She has a 7.5 or an 8 in all of the categories except writing, where she got a 6.5. She has redone the IELTS twice, but she needs a 7 in every category to get registered under the current regulations. When she started her course, that was not the case. She has been offered jobs by just about everyone. Australian hospitals are aghast they cannot employ her at her appropriate level because of the 6.5. She has excellent grades. Her clinical writing is considered excellent by all who see it. She is educated, she is eloquent, and somehow, she has hit some kind of culturally obtuse test that threatens her chosen vocation. Talking to an educator, the view is that many academics would probably score 6.5 in a similar test. But of course, we all use word processors and grammar checks to check and to fix everything that is measured in a handwritten, stress, time-related test. Now, it's one student, but it's a profound effect of our often hysterical, media-driven, soundbite approach to a big policy, English language policy in Australia. It has consequences that are beginning to make us look, at best, xenophobic. What is the evidence that IELTS 7 in every category is correct for productivity and education in Australia? Call me soft, but why is it we are so bound up in English language proficiency rather than intellect and ideas, while our competitor jurisdictions, the US, the UK, and Germany, are not? Now, here is a policy debate we should short out and which may have some value to all parts of our sector. What about some reasoned research that informs a policy position that is then enabled and evaluated and is enduring? I continually hear the lament, to my next point, that universities and TAFE must be managed together more stringently under the same rules. Why? We have clear and separate business objectives which align nicely if you bother to get involved. The dual sectors have chosen that route, and for some it works extremely well. I wonder sometimes if it's worth the pain because of some of the duplication, but I've not worked in one, so I don't know. I do, however, meet students who've been through that system, and they adore it. Universities like Deakin, unaligned, have been very successful with TAFE pathways and partnerships in the vet sector, despite us not being dual sector. In our case, the Gordon TAFE in Geelong last year approached me and handed over their degree, two degrees actually. Their view, it was not part of their core business. They were achieving the targets they needed to achieve for their market very nicely, thank you, and meeting all of their equity things. We now have a very complementary approach. We often do many things together in the markets that we serve. But we are different. We have a great business relationship, and it works. What will integration bring to this? Anything at all? I'm not sure. However, to get back to the preamble, and of course, if we do have a tighter, more integrated model, it should probably address specialisation as it currently is being attempted in the compacts. Integration is not one size fits all, but how do we get to specialisation, and will compacts, which could be part of an integrated model, allow that to happen? We need to address regionality, especially regional funding inadequacies. We need to educate more people where they are, geographically and academically, and universities can't do that on their own. The capacity of our regional centres needs to be further developed. For those of us with regional campuses, we continue to struggle with the current arrangements, especially the rate at which they change. Compacts could probably deal with this, or a general policy might. But then, you know, there's the next election, and I'm betting that the words regional and independent may cease to exist in the Australian vernacular. An integrated model should avoid duplication of the things the AQF, TEXA, and the national accrediting bodies already do. Will that happen? They need to avoid duplication between what the states and the Commonwealth measure. That'll never happen, but we should ask for it. So my preferred approach as a self-centred Vice-Chancellor with a university with KPIs and a council is that we need to test compacts as an idea to get the specialisation and differentiation we need. Let's test deregulation as a means to see what happens to choice and market supply across VET and universities. Let's test TEXA as an idea to achieve some semblance of standards across the sector. And of course, there's 190 of us consumed in all of that. Can we use existing frameworks and get a light touch? Can TEXA and eventually its sister organisation enable a more improved approach under the objects of necessity, risk and proportion to deter the foolhardy and stop the fraudulent? Because that's what a lot of this is about. Will compacts, and perhaps this could be extended to all providers, not set the specialisation and differentiation agenda that is essential to the success of both the University of Melbourne and Deakin? Let's smooth the dreaded AQF. Can the AQF, with a bit of loosening, provide the necessary framework for qualifications? I think we need a proper conversation about a tertiary sector that as a whole, must be world-class. Not just 4 or 6 or 8 special universities, but universities, TAFEs, and we need to embrace the private providers. They cannot remain the barbarians at the door. The market will never allow it. So I think there's a sensible conversation about funding productivity and where this is best served from the perspective of the nation. It probably does mean some form of integration, but let's be very careful what we wish for. We've done that too many times in the last little while, and we may just swing the pendulum back the other way and be here in a couple of years. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane, and thank you, Glenn. That was two fabulous presentations, which I hope have set the scene for a very healthy discussion. The other observation I'd like to make before we open it up for questions is it was good of Jane to mention a fair chance for all, because it really is an exemplary piece of policy work in Australia. And I think that the thing that distinguishes a fair chance for all from some of the policy work we see at the moment is that that was a very mature policy document. There was a substantial investment of resources and time in the preparation of a fair chance for all. And we don't seem to devote that kind of a period of maturation at the moment.
And it has stood the test of time. For a long time, if you remember, and I'm sure I'm looking at Margaret now, in the ATN, I mean, this became a big thing right through the 90s as to what we should do and how the ATN would do it. And it's been enduring. I think it's an interesting, and it reads beautifully. I read it all again the other night because I've still got an original copy, and I occasionally show it at to people who, you know, rant on about access. It's a beautifully written policy.
Mm. Mm. Okay, so over to you.
Oh, well, then we can talk amongst ourselves.
That's, looks that way. Although I can't, I've got no voice.
Excellent. All right. Gavin Moody.
Well, you're back in the kitchen.
Kat, please.
Should there be both a university campus and a TAFE campus in Wodonga, Shepparton, Mildura, Warrnambool?
Well, to quote the previous chair of the Universities Australia board, there's not too many universities, there's just too many campuses. I think thin markets, for me, are a problem. I can tell you Warrnambool belongs to Deakin. We have, I think it's just over 1,500 EFTIL. We got an ERA 4 for aquatic marine science, which is an amazing outcome. For the people of Warrnambool, the university is everything. They're about to put up a sign, "Welcome to Warrnambool, a university town." How do you take something away that you have? So I think the answer is interesting, and I don't know how you close things that you've opened, so you have to be careful what you wish for. I think probably it's very thin. Now, 1,500 is heading. We need about 1,900 students to absolutely break even. What I can tell you about Warrnambool, which comes back to some of the principles that we have here, is that at Warrnambool, just the other day, the top medical students in the final unit of the first graduating class of medical students at Deakin started at Warm Ponds in Geelong, where it is, and spent the final 2 years of, she's a mature age woman, children, in Warrnambool, and did it all from there, and has topped out. And you think, that makes quite a difference to policy in Australia, that person is now a qualified medical practitioner in Warrnambool. Now, Warrnambool's never had this many GPs that it's about to have, and that's a good thing for it. So I'm not so sure, but I think you need to be careful. I'm not sure that Deakin, as a consequence of Warrnambool, could ever compete with Melbourne, but we don't want to. It's a different market, and I think there's not been sufficient addressing of specialisation. Everybody's gone right off about the rankings this morning, and you've left Deakin off. We're right on that list at number 22, but ignoring all that, I thought, be nice, you're over here. But that's the point, isn't it, that we are all going to be different in the system. What I think, though, is it's interesting that we have as many people up there that we do, and I notice La Trobe does very well, and I notice James Cook's does very well, and they have campuses everywhere. Albury-Wodonga, though, is a nightmare because it's across the border, and you've got the Commonwealth plus two state governments, and you know, nobody would wish that on anyone. That's a long answer.
Yeah. Clearly, we should be looking at this, and it was very interesting in the state budget this year, the Victorian government put $20 million into a fund to encourage cooperation across TAFE campus boundaries, and I thought that was a very far-sighted initiative and worth seeing how it goes.
Yeah, I mean, the point was that you solve the problems of all of those towns I mentioned, and we could multiply those by establishing integrated dual sector institutions. That is not giving them two separate campuses, and the dual sector architecture would solve that problem.
You could. But you would do that on a case-by-case basis. What I'm horrified by is that we dream up something like the Hewers for integration, and my God, we'd spend 5 years putting it together, cost $100 million, and then we'd know it was wrong and we'd start again. And we've got to do this in an extraordinarily considered way, but Glenn's going to tell you in a much better way than I have.
Captured it very nicely. And never fully answer a question from Gavin, because he'll have another one if you...
Oh, sorry. Kat, I wonder if we could grab that microphone.
Gavin, I like you. It's all right.
Please.
Jane, you talked about the AQF as really the only... Oh, OK, thank you. The only integrated policy framework we really do have in Australia at present. And we, you know, we've gone through the new regulatory arrangements, and they're still all separate. Do either of you really see any other policy areas, which is the focus as distinct from institutional arrangements, where a more integrated approach could be applied and would be beneficial?
I'll have a go if I may. excuse me. It seems to me we made a potential category mistake in talking about an integrated system as though the key variable in this was the institutions, where we should have been thinking about the students. And it seems to me a student in year 12 faces a really difficult set of choices when the financial arrangements to go to TAFE are so profoundly different from those for university, and there are a number of quite worrying aspects of TAFE funding and the way it plays out to students and families, particularly from disadvantage, that those excellent figures from Holmes Glen almost achieved in spite of. And
Where I think there'd be huge benefit in an integrated system was with a single pathway for students about the cost. And that's the state-commonwealth divide at work. And that's why, as Joan rightly said, it's such a difficult thing to sort out. But in fact, if there was an economic cost and the same set of rules to going to TAFE, to going to a private provider, to going to university, you knew what the choices were, and the choices were on the same spectrum and paid for with the same range of choice, you'd have a much better system for students as they make what are very important decisions still made by many people not sure what it is they want to do. And that's where I think there's real benefit. And it's not felt at the institutional level, we wouldn't notice necessarily. It felt profoundly important for those flowing in.
Yeah, I think admissions, funding, and then how to get in is very complicated. And even in universities, my previous university, when we looked at it, you know, we were trying to work out something or other, and we found we had 17 different ways of being admitted to the university. That was interesting. And then you add TAFE to all of that. How do you get a much more streamlined point of access, particularly for those who have no idea about the system? Is it possible? Well, I think everything's possible if you give it good policy, but it comes down to a good policy that might work. The problem with the AQF is it's gone too far and it got a bit stiff, as you know. We'd all moved on past where it was, and it had to catch up. But it has, and maybe it will be robust enough now that it's a bit of give and take. How would you do that to admission and funding is really hard. And the problem I come back to is how do you understand the balance of teaching and research funding in the university, which is something that many people in this room would cherish and see as the differentiator. And how do we make sure that people just don't see us as more expensive than VET? We're different from VET, and I think we need to be careful and enunciate that continuum better than we currently do, particularly in places like where I am, less so in the Sandstones particularly, less so to an extent in the ATN, but not really. A lot of the, you know, a number of the ATNs are dual sector and are dealing with that problem every day. You know, there's Margaret's in the room. She can probably say things about that.
I don't want to say something about that. I just... 2 seconds on just a follow-up on your integrated policy question. The one area you didn't pick up was, of course, international students and the ESOS Act. Might I point out that there we seem to be able to have overarching national regulation, whatever we might think about it. We don't worry about admission. We, of course, control funding quite differently. Can I just throw that to you and get you to comment?
In a sense, I tried to conclude by saying many of the elements of a national framework are there if we want to pull them together. The ESOS Act, I think, supports that point.
I mean, there's parts of the ESOS Act which are interesting, and I could have used that. I mean, I looked at it with the AQF, but the AQF was much more dramatic. And because we've all had such a personal experience of it with the fights we've had over it, I thought people would like it. But I agree with you totally. And if you looked at it from the student perspective, ESOS is much more important than ever the AQF will be.
Yeah, good point.
Margaret Mazzolini from Swinburne, who should have been on Richard's list too, but I wouldn't mention that. I was interested in Glyn Davis's comment about, son of Universities Commission and whether TEXA can pick up that ball and run with it. And I think it makes all sorts of sense to take possibly some of the heat out of the political side of policy setting to have a structure like that. I'm just pondering over whether it's the organisation that also does the audits, hands out the money. I mean, I'd just like to explore that a little bit more.
I know not enough about how the Australian Universities Commission operated when we had it. It was probably went through a number of changes over time, so probably you've got to work out which version you're dealing with. The Hong Kong system, which is based on curiously based on the original Australian system, they've kept it while we has a board of 25 or so and a series of subgroups, including an audit subgroup, which effectively operates. So the Hong Kong qualifications framework, which is heavily lifted from Australia, is the responsibility of this committee, but it has a subgroup that avoids conflict of interest by having a group of people who are not players in the field, and that's how they do the audit function as well. So they all report up to the committee and they work in great detail. And the advantage is that knowledge about institutions is profound at the committee level. So if the Baptist University of Hong Kong has issues, the auditors know it, the finance people know it, they work together, and then they work with the institution to get it back on track. One of the interesting things is how well funded Hong Kong universities are compared to Australia. You just try not to weep as you go through the funding model, and how relatively modest their performance is with lots more money. Mm. There's some sobering lessons there about innovation and ingenuity when necessity drives you. I mean, we would be thrilled to be funded at the rate they are, but what is impressive is how consistent are the checks on the quality of the infrastructure, how much attention goes to the student experience, and the committee, for example, meets every year with groups of students. Now, no Australian regulator, to my knowledge, has ever done that. But actually, that's huge, profoundly important. And it listens to this famous argument have every year between the students who turn up willing to speak to the committee, most of who are not from Hong Kong, but insist on speaking in Cantonese because they're making a nationalist point about how Hong Kong should be. And they get told off by the chair, typically in Cantonese, about why they shouldn't be. But you get to see the whole dynamics of the system, and this one group builds this collective capital about what it is that happens in the system. No one has that capital. Ours is divided between multiple agencies, between two federal departments. There aren't a group of experts who've actually got a picture of the system in their head and a working model of what we're trying to achieve and the levers to do it. And it's interesting to think what you might be able to do under that model.
But you wouldn't want the Indian model, which is the other university grants committee, which is a nightmare by all accounts. And, you know, things take a long, long time. I don't know that they work on an annual budget cycle because it takes longer. And, you know, and I think you'd want to go to a ruthlessly efficient model that you have in there. And that's what...
Andrew Nork.
Now we're in trouble.
Yeah. But he loved the productivity paper, so that's okay.
just first to add one to the partial integration list, which is the spread of fee help into the vocational sector, also an example, I think, of how integration may not work terribly well because the repayment thresholds are designed for university graduates, and I suspect that this is effectively a grant scheme for a lot of vocational graduates because they will never earn enough to completely repay their loans. So that's one integration problem. But wasn't what I actually wanted to ask about, which is really to either speaker, which is about not so much integration between voc ed and higher ed, but within higher ed, whether the accreditation system and the funding system should be integrated so that as soon as you are approved to say to be a teaching institution, you also get the same funding as all the other institutions.
Mm. I thought TEXA would take all that, but I haven't given it enough thought.
Mm. Are you going to the Teaching Research Nexus question in asking that?
Partly.
Yeah, I assume so. So if we have a view that universities are research institutions as well as teaching institutions, then accreditation in higher ed should either be as a higher ed provider or a university, and a funding rate should flow depending on that. This is fraught territory, given that we've got degrees being delivered now by non-universities. If funding flows on the same principle, they're being funded at a rate that at least nominally is meant to include money toward research. So I think you couldn't do that. Yeah, you'd have to unpick that before you...
Yeah.
Wouldn't you use the TEXA clause? I haven't got it to the top of my mind now, which is about this teaching research thing that the word university will hold. So if you're a non-university, and I presume the boxes, the bowls will have to be exclusive, you would get in this bowl here, which would be the TAFEs and those sorts of things, you would get the kind of money that would do the teaching side. So you'd have to work that out. And I thought that was one of the more interesting things in the UA paper, was trying to look at what is the difference for a university which is now obliged to do research to hold the title because of this creation of new knowledge, whereas in a vet you're not obliged to create the new knowledge, so you get a different bowl of money. What I think is interesting is how you deal with the students and their fee help and how that all works. It'll have to be proportionate, and we've not worked that out. And that's an example of where policy was done quickly and nobody ever thought through the consequences, and we should have. And now here we are.
There may be a Trojan horse in Andrew's question, though, which is about CSP and whether CSP is actually a public institution entity or whether accreditation should allow, that is this a demand-driven system which any institution can pick up a CSP place?
Table A is purely historical. Yeah. No
precisely.
Yeah. So
yeah.
Now that we have this integrated TEXA accreditation, why shouldn't we bring in the funding system to match it?
Then you would run into the further policy question of how could you do that if you had a system which private providers can take both CSP and fee-paying students, but public institutions can't. Of course, such a system is unthinkable, except anywhere. We've already got it, Bond and Notre Dame.
And so, I mean, that's a perfect example of something that's really bad.
Yeah,
so it's bad. That's bad policy.
And then you're on your way.
Wesley.
Yes, I speak as the granddaughter of wharf labourers, and I want to know from both of you how adventurous you plan to be in your institutions with access and equity. What pathways genuinely will you make?
Yeah, it's interesting. Do you want me to go first?
Yeah, please.
I'll talk about Deakin. So we have a campus in southeast Melbourne which sits on a low SES of 7% in a university that overall is going for 14%. So it shows you that Geelong, most particularly Waterfront and Warm Ponds, which are going towards 10,000 students now, and then Warrnambool, which is of 1,800, if it's all, by the next year, are taking a really heavy load. So we have looked at doing ATARs at a different level. One standard is one standard, but it's tough. How do you do education where you are, which is the academically underprepared, and how can you afford it in a university that must aspire to be in the Shanghai Jia Tong and all of these things? And that's the challenge, I think. How do you have classes that are small enough? And I take Glenn's point. How do you afford engineering when you're doing access and participation and you have students who don't know three of the four? You know, there's double maths, double sci to be a great engineer, and you're giving them academic support in two or three of those. I think that's quite a tough challenge. What I'm interested in is how VET can do any of that any more efficiently. And we've got quite an interesting little program going with the Gordon to see whether there's some things that we can do together and share the load. And maybe you're looking at a slightly different lens to the degree. I don't think it's straightforward. It's certainly not simple in places that want to aspire. The biggest problem is taking your staff with you. We want all of our staff to be research active. How do you do that? That's quite tough when you have no benefaction and the money seems quite tight. But what we've looked at is starting to look at a differential model. The further you get away from Melbourne and get to the icebergs, the model changes slightly. What I can say is our student satisfaction and our attainment at Warrnambool is the best across the university. The classes there tend to be small. They're pretty much borderline, profitable is not the right word, breaking even. How long do you balance that as you start to get more and more people who want to spend more and more of their time on research? And shouldn't we be doing that? Because that's what a university is. So there's the challenge. Should some of those people be in the vet sector? You know, I'm like you, you know. University changed my life. You know, I want people to have the chance I had. I was lucky, I was quite clever, so there were scholarships and things. But for some of our people here, there aren't those things. So what do we do? I think it's good. I take, the point is Warrnambool campus serves a brilliant purpose. Hopefully one day it will be a Prime Minister and a Nobel Prize winner from there, but it's a great cost to the community.
Can I address it in a slightly different way? Can I ask how many people in the room are the children of graduates?
Two graduates.
How many are in the Gavin Moody camp? Two graduates, right.
Yeah.
Okay. So at best, at best a quarter of the room come from families where somebody went to university. That's actually high for Australia, which tells you just how profoundly important university education is in transforming opportunities. So three quarters of the room, Leslie-Anne, probably share with you a background that in two generations people go from wharf labourers to being professionals. And that's why equity matters, or participation matters. It's why it's important to get through. It's interesting to think it's Labor Day weekend just passed in the United States. Mm. So it's the weekend when all the trees in New England start to turn colour, to change colour and become copper and stunning. And it's the weekend where parents deliver their children to college or university for classes that start this week. And astonishingly, 70% of people who finished year 12 back in their equivalent back in May and June, 70% of those qualified students are now starting this week college or university. And that is how important it's become in the United States to have tertiary qualifications of some sort. Now, of course, their range of institutions is vastly, that's effectively saying from TAFE through to university, but it's still an astonishing figure. What's astonishing, however, is when you survey Americans about do you expect your children to go to college, 90% say it is now their expectations that their children will go to college. So this transformation over several generations, when we talk about 40%, we're a long way behind societies we'd consider equivalent to, we would aspire to share with, we're a long way still behind the United Kingdom. So it matters who gets in. And to answer the specific question, at Melbourne we've set ourselves a target of taking 25% of our undergraduate cohort through access and equity programs, and we achieved that in 2011 for the first time. But half our student cohort is graduate, and it's a lot more difficult to know what it is you're measuring when you talk about low SES into graduate class. Is it parents' income still when you're dealing with people in their 20s and 30s? Is that a reasonable proxy? It's the only one we can use because the only alternative is postcodes, which is even less reliable. And so we use parents' education attainment because that's actually the most reliable guide we can find. And we're aiming for a similar figure at graduate level.
I guess I want to add one other thing, is this obsession with ATARs in Australia, which is different to the obsession in the UK where some of my experience is, and how we compare, you know, oh, Deakin's ATARs crashed to 75, you know, the University of Melbourne's at 98, and of course the University of Melbourne is doing all sorts of other things. And the obsession that we compare ourselves in a sector, and your points about America. America has quite an interesting system right across, as all of you would know, and Glenn has explained. And why is it that Deakin can't aspire to have a very profound and useful contribution in Australia, which is different from RMIT and different from the University of Melbourne, different from Swinburne, but that we look at ensuring that the sector is robust, quality-driven standards and going to world-class. And the ranking schmankings, which say that broadly we're doing something like that, but we're all bursting at the seams and getting cross and exhausted. And, of course, nobody wants to work in academia anymore, which is the big problem. Where is the next generation going to come from if we don't ensure it's attractive? So it seems to me there's a moose in the room around differentiation and specialisation and what excellence means. And excellence means different things depending on what you're talking about. And for many students, for many of us, it was getting a degree. What we did with that degree was entirely then voluntary, but the world had changed for us. Certainly the world changed for me. I mean, I was a South African. You know, my father actually believed in the South African system. So my world seriously changed when I got my degree. And I'm sure everyone has stories, but it's different if you're looking at, you know, genuinely making a difference to new knowledge. Can we do those things in a harmonious system and stop some of this looking at each other? And, you know, I think it's interesting. And we've not moved on enough for me to get to good policy, which will then in our true integration, which is the integration of equals, who are different and specialising, rather than the integration on a vertical line, which has people at the top and people at the bottom who do things in a different way, and money's flicked over the fence occasionally, which, you know, some people have espoused to me quite clearly as a reasonable system. And of course, Geelong is so much cheaper, someone said to me the other day, well, for goodness sake, you know, dealt with them quickly.
Vin.
Go back to the coordinating authority or CTEC. First of all, just to a bit of history, yes, the Universities Commission did used to allocate the funding, but where it got into trouble and the CTEC later was that it asked for too much and the government said, no, we won't have that one again. We'll now give you some parameters within which you must report. So you can't just ask for what the universities need. You can only ask for the amount of money that's in this particular envelope. When it came to CTEC, the problem was that, again, the government felt that they were threatened by this other authority, which was telling them what to do or suggesting it in a public way, which then caused the government to have to explain why they weren't handing over the money. Nevertheless, it was a good system. And just to pick up on some of the answers to the questions that we heard before, I don't think I would put it within TECSA. I think it has to be the other way around, because the sort of system that's going to work is like the one in Hong Kong, which is actually looking at the system from an expert point of view and understanding it. It can do the compacts. It can go in there and talk rationally to people about compacts. We can overcome the issues about, well, my university is able to do this much research and this much teaching and come to a rational conclusion about it, rather than every university must do this much teaching and this much research or else. And I think that that's where we're going to get into trouble over the next few years. If TECSA is asking for one thing, the AQF is suggesting something else, the other department is asking us to do so much research rather than this much, and there's nobody there to actually arbitrate, to decide, well, what do we do? And the compacts then just become a nonsense. So I think, despite the fact that I suspect that the current government is still concerned about having an authority which is going to start telling them or advising them what to do, that's really going to be the only way that we're going to be able to solve the problem.
Vin, thank you. If I observe and totally agree with you that under the Hong Kong model, the functions of TECSA would be sub-units and sub-committees of the Hong Kong Grants Committee necessary. And we have a real risk here of incoherence. We have an AQF and academic standards to follow from TECSA to be proclaimed bearing no relationship to the funding model. So you may well have standards imposed on you, but no way of paying for them, and there's no way to resolve that tension. Clearly, the world has moved on in many ways. I mean, under the previous CTEC and so on, capital was decided centrally, for example. Now, nobody would want to do that again. The model of rolling capital into student payments and fund, allowing institutions to make their own capital choices, because the 1960s gave us such memorable buildings as... I can see from behind us, I can't see it, but just behind us is the Redmond Barry building opened in 1961, which the builder proudly proclaimed was the cheapest per square foot building ever constructed in Australia. And it still shows. And it was done because CTEC or the commission provided money for a building, and the university then took the money and saw how far it could stretch it. So a lighter hand than an older regulatory model, but one that does have a forum in which you face the inherent contradictions of any complex system and have a way of discussing them and reaching whatever the trade-offs are necessary to make the system work seems to me really worthwhile. And we don't have anything in sight. TECSA can't do that because it sits a bit like a judiciary making pronouncements. And that's a necessary part of the system. I don't criticise it for that, but it doesn't... Well, we're relying at this stage on the Minister for Education to perform that function, because that's the only person who nominally has oversight, and even they don't have oversight of the research system, which for some institutions is a third or half of what they do. So it's a very nice set of observations that you've given us about how it might work.
Yeah. Usually you do, Andrew.
Yeah.
I can ask a question.
Andrew Transom.
Andrew Transom, this round. Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
With regards to the integration idea, and this is off the hoof, but there's been concerns raised in the vet sector, or about the vet sector, about the level of skills deepening that occurs in vet and the training packages. And I was wondering to what degree that could be a spur to integration that could, or a need for it. I mean, does the vet need to learn a bit about making skills somehow more transferable, and therefore is integration with universities a way of doing that or not? Just wondering what you think of that.
I think we do that anyway.
Yes. It's a great question. I have no expertise on TAFE, although I'm one of the few people I suspect in the room has actually done a TAFE course just to try it out from start to finish.
Did you pass?
And I did, yes, in mathematics. And competency was achieved, yes. I mean, it's a very different way of delivery and a different way of learning, but extremely valid in its own right, and it was well delivered, and I was impressed. But it was quite different from the university experience necessarily. It was. Now, I think it'd be silly for Jane, or certainly silly for me, and perhaps for Jane as well, to comment on the vet packages and how they're assessed. But there are people in the room who work in systems with both who might well want to say something.
Please. Bernie Marshall from Deakin. I'm looking at the title up on the screen, An Integrated Policy Framework for Tertiary Education. What we've talked a fair bit about is a policy for integrated tertiary education. And I'd really like to think about what are the other policies, and therefore the other sectors within the policies area, that we really need to be aware of and engaging with. So who else do we need? Where's the real agenda for us? Jane's mentioned a few things about productivity, but it would be good to think about the broader policy framework that would impact on higher education, and not just the framework around higher education.
Nice one, Bernie.
You're asking how higher education in turn fits into a broader national agenda.
Well, I was really thinking,
I mean, the arguments for integration are around access, participation, productivity, quality of education experience.
Yeah. I was just taking through integrated what are the policy frameworks that need to be integrated in relation to the future of higher education? And some of those are explicitly about higher education and an integrated system. But there's also a broader policy framework which is impacting on us. Migration, productivity, employment. And so I'm just wondering, what are the other policy drivers, the policy areas that we in higher ed need to be aware of and starting to monitor, to be involved with, to advocate about, that are important in the future of higher ed in Australia?
I mean, from K, so starting at kindergarten upwards, I mean, schools policy is profoundly important to higher education because of supply, nothing else. I mean, you know, we can't do anything without people who have some basic education. I think there's a real breakdown there. I think the funding policy must get closer to the standards policy. The whole CTEC arguments are quite interesting, but a lot of that broke down. And I remember once Alan Robson saying, over his dead body, did we ever go back to CTEC, because it was such a miserable experience when he was part of it in the very early days. And so how do you make that really smart and sophisticated and sexy as you have now? And I think that's where we need to proceed with caution to get it right. But I'm not sure I'm understanding. I think there's a disconnect. For me, the big disconnect is often with schools to university. We're getting increasing numbers of academically underprepared students. And somehow universities are being blamed, or, you know, I notice employers always going on and on and on about nobody can, you know, do the apostrophe. Well, I think apostrophe is something you learn in level six or not. Maybe you should abandon the apostrophe, I don't know. But is there a good continuum there? I'm unsure. And that, of course, is very separately managed from everything else. But in the end, it's about funding and standards in universities. But I don't know, Glenn, you'd have a wiser head than me in that.
This university has professors walk, and academic board had a long and sustained debate about where the apostrophe should be in professors walk. If it's Professor apostrophe S, then only one professor can walk at a time. If it's Professors S apostrophe, all should walk together. So we went for Professors Walk exclamation mark and solved the problem. Two quotes. One is someone who said that the trouble with government is that everything is connected to everything else. Yeah. And interestingly, that was Vladimir Lenin who said that about his experience running this early Soviet Union. And the nice contrast is a quote from John F. Kennedy, who said something like, "I've always found that when everything is working really well and government is highly coordinated, nothing is happening." Governments are by their nature incoherent. It's the nature of the governing enterprise. No matter how much you try and organise the machinery of government and the selection and the decision processes, there's an element of perverseness. And it's easy, you can make fun of it all the time. We run anti-smoking campaigns and we fund tobacco farmers. We do both for different and sensible reasons, and we end up with incoherence. So higher education is always going to have to jostle for attention in a policy environment in which, for many people, it's either not relevant or, in fact, positively an irritant, getting in the way of what they want to do. So one of the reasons that I guess an independent body might be quite useful is because it would provide a powerful voice for the sector back into government, which we have in part, but we have through two agencies, education and a research agency, and each has different agendas, and we've all commented in the compacts process, even those two agendas don't necessarily align as you might hope. So if we're going to powerfully influence government and try and deal with migration, education, housing, all of the transport, all of the policies that might affect what it is we do as universities, getting a voice inside government is a key and important part of that.
Actually, but I think linking public transport policy to higher education would be genius.
True. Yeah. Well, on our way to an early mark.
I think we're nearly done. Margaret, I'm wondering also, I cut Gavin off rudely before, whether we should offer him another opportunity.
I'm pulling my head in now.
Good on you. Margaret.
I was just thinking whether I wanted to take the bait on Andrew's question about skills deepening or not. And I guess the comment I'd make from a dual sector coping with these things is a bit similar to what Glyn said about if in higher ed the performance funding isn't tied in some way to the standards of tech, so that we get into this dilemma of cross purposes and not funding to drive behaviours, and it's in the end it's the money that'll win. In the vet sector, one of the dilemmas I see for a dual sector is that the state-based funding, especially in Victoria with contestability at vet funding and the skills deepening agenda, is driving vet behaviour in a very different direction. And I've got no views on which is right and wrong, but you've got issues about emphasis on completions, emphasis on teacher efficiency compared to in higher ed, where you'd be talking about staff-student ratios. You've got recognition of prior learning, and so the funding. And there's a lot of things in the way states are and can, and some states are and others can fund VET that is actually driving it in different directions. This will be a big challenge for ASCA and TEXA if they come together, but more to the point, it's a particular challenge for dual sectors as we try and make those pathways work. And it'll be a challenge for other universities trying to do the pathways through from VET too. So if we're serious about using pathways to widen access and attainment, well, we don't want to get rid of the separate missions and issues of the VET and higher ed sector. We do have dilemmas of how the different agendas between state and federal funding are driving the two sectors, I think.
Yeah, thank you for that. Do we have a final question at all? Andrew.
If I could just ask about the Universities of Australia productivity report that came out.
You got so close.
Yeah. How optimistic are you that a call for productivity gains that are out into the future of 2040 is going to resonate with government at the moment, both sides of politics want to cut at the moment, and with the broader public? And I was just wondering whether perhaps the sector needs to talk a bit more about quality and the dangers to quality. I mean, the report points out the staff-student ratios have blown out. From what I can tell, they're just continuing to blow out. And to get the attention out there of people like the media that I have to try and sell stories to, and the politicians, is productivity gains in 2040 really going to get the change you want, or do you really need to start warning that they're going to start getting graduates who can't do what they're supposed to do?
Andrew, it's always a question of partly of tactics and partly of what you're trying to achieve. On tactics, our sector has got no interest in coming out and trashing our own members and what they do. We might all fret about staff-student ratios. We might all wish they were better, but that's a different proposition from coming out and saying quality is about to collapse. Actually, there's no evidence that quality is about collapse. And although we would prefer smaller classes, the dirty secret of this sector, as of schools, is there's not a lot of evidence that smaller classes actually produce better learning outcomes. So we have to be careful about running that. But I guess the point about the productivity report, and we've been working on it for a long time, we couldn't know there was going to be a debate last week about productivity, is that the productivity debate in this country bizarrely ends up being about wage levels. It ends up being about whether or not we're going to lower people's wages in order to improve national productivity. And this was a very deliberate attempt to say there are much better and profoundly more effective ways of lifting productivity, and they have to do with where you invest as a government. So yes, 2040 is some time away, and the chart started, it showed what the productivity gains from investment would be next year and the year after through to 2040. And it was designed to make the point that we actually know the productivity payoffs of a whole set of investment, a whole set of actions, including changes to industrial relations through to investing in various forms of skills. And we know that education is about the best productivity investment we can make. And if you want to say, how would you know that? As a non-economist, you would say simply, look at the behaviour of individuals about that 90% of parents who want to put their kids into, they know that their lives and all of the measures of their lives are profoundly improved by access to education, that what they contribute back will rise and what it makes possible for them as individuals to rise. Well, that's true for individuals, it's true for the nation. Parents are doing what the nation we're inviting to do, and that's investing in education, knowing that it makes a difference individually and collectively. So that report is an attempt to say, if we're going to have a productivity debate, fabulous, let's look at what the evidence actually says, and let's have a broader debate than the narrow terms in which we always talk about in this country. Hence the reason. Are there better ways of making our case? I'm sure there are. Universities aren't particularly skilled advocates for what we do. The fact that most of the public are perfectly happy with the university sector and completely uninterested in what it does is evidence that we haven't motivated a broader understanding of what we do. But I think this productivity evidence is a good way of making the point that if we're going to have the debate, let's have the real debate, not the faux debate that we constantly come back to, as though productivity is a debate for or against work choices, as though that were the most significant part of it, when in fact it turns out to be not.
Do you want to add to that? It was a pretty good off-the-cuff response.
Yeah, not really. I agree, though, it's going to be hard to sell productivity to my neighbours, who I hope would vote for the government that's going to fund higher education, and they don't get it. What they get is a great university down the road with fabulous buildings, which they love going into. I think it's a very hard proposition to sell that this place is struggling for money. Most people just wouldn't get it. That's where we have to get to. So I think this is about how we persuade government, and I think it comes back to how do we get good policy that comes out of the political spectrum for a while, because it will be good for the country. And I don't know how you get that in the kind of bipartisan, strange, peculiar system we have at the moment, where one side are doing all sorts of things, and whether you like the carbon tax or not, at least they're having a go, and all the other side's doing is saying, no, it's wrong, which isn't an alternative. How do we get back to, I don't know that there were ever any good old days about this, to having a considered debate about what the options might be. And we don't seem to have options debates anymore. We have one side saying something and the other side just says it's rubbish. and that doesn't give anyone any hope. What I notice is that most people are turning off any kind of interest in democracy, which is actually a much more fundamental issue, maybe even than higher education. And how do we get people interested in having a reasonable say might be one of the problems we have to face in our current climate that we find ourselves in. But then in America, what's it, 25% of the people vote or something? Some appallingly small number, and yet they manage to stay consistent on some things, but because they don't matter to the people. What I'm interested in is, why is higher education the kind of football it is? Why is Tony Abbott, for example, just the other day said the moment he gets in, he'll get rid of the amenities and services fee? Why would he care about that? It's such a small amount of money. And we haven't got it, and precisely it's not even back yet. And this was as a result of some question from a student. So why is he so focused on that? Why wouldn't they all be, why wouldn't both sides be looking at what 2040 looks like, so that their legacy? You know, one of the great things about some of the things that the Hawke Keating government did in Fair Chance for All is that there is a legacy there, and we look back and say that was where it began, and people start to think about things. Wouldn't all governments be worried about that? Apparently not. I find that just astonishing at the moment. Oh, just amazing. Sorry, off topic
so,
completely.
No, thank you. I mean, we finished with two wonderful responses to a fine question. What better way of finishing? So thank you both for excellent presentations and for a very healthy, candid conversation that followed them.